You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, all you wiretappers out there. I'm here in the studio of Gangland Wire. I have on the line Ray Morrow, a retired FBI agent. I first heard Ray on another podcast. There's a lady named Jerry Williams, a retired FBI agent that has a podcast. God, all of a sudden I forgot the name of his FBI file. Just, you know, if you want to search for it, I'll have a link to it on my show notes. And just Google Jerry, J-E-R-I, Williams, and FBI and podcast. You'll find it. She's got a couple of books she's written, and she's got a whole bunch of retired FBI agents on her podcast. I was on there. She won't really have cops on there. She'll only have agents, but got my friend Bill Owsley from here in Kansas City. He and I went on and talked about the skimming investigation that we were involved in. So, Ray, welcome.
Thank you, Gary. Really a pleasure for you to have me. I really thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Well, Ray, now, you were with the FBI how long?
21 years.
And where did you start out? Actually, let's go back a little bit before that. How did you first get interested in becoming an FBI agent?
That's a good story. And it goes all the way back to my child. From early 60s, when the FBI program with Ephraim Zimlis Jr. came on, I just got really, really enthralled with the FBI and Ephraim Zimlis Jr. and that whole show. And I never missed an episode. And that led me to look more into the FBI. And this is, you know, I'm 9, 10, 11 years old at the time. And I really was amazed by J. Edgar Hoover. Everything I could read about J. Edgar Hoover, and any time he was on TV, I made sure I watched and paid attention to what he had to say. And it was funny because as I started to continue to go through junior high and high school, my plan was to become an agent. My father's plan was for me to become a pharmacist. And so there was constant back and forth with my father not telling me I'm not going to the FBI, I'm going to be a pharmacist. It's a great, great job. It's, you know, and finally, I just one day walked out to him and said, and gave him all the reasons why I should be an FBI agent and all the reasons why I shouldn't be a pharmacist. And the first one started with my grades in science and chemistry were not very good. And at that point, he just looked at me and says, well, if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. And that was it. And so from that point forward, it was all law enforcement. I went to Penn State University and graduated with a law enforcement corrections degree. And right out of college, I went to the FBI as a clerk. Moved to Washington, D.C., making about less than $6,000 a year. And spent the year there training to be a fingerprint examiner. And I found that that's a very boring job and very tedious. And I figured I better find something else because my thought was, well, once they see me, they'll make me an agent right away. Well, and that, you know, that doesn't happen that way. So then I applied and was hired by the U.S. Secret Service Uniform Division. So for 2 years, I worked at the White House protecting Jimmy Carter and the first family in the White House. That was just a fantastic opportunity for someone like me from a small town outside of Pittsburgh, being able to be at the White House and you know, protect the president and his family. It was just quite an honor. And at that point, though, my father had passed away, very young age of 51, and I kind of wanted to get back to Pittsburgh. So I applied for a couple of jobs and got hired by a company called Allegheny International to protect the president of the corporation. And so I did that for 7 years. And at that point, the president that I was protecting had retired. And I was getting ready to move on. So I said, you know what? Now's the time to apply for FBI, be an agent. And I did in the February 1987, I was hired and went to Quantico.
Wow. You were focused, laser focused from an early age.
Well, I was. And I think the reason was, I knew I didn't have very many other abilities or capabilities. I knew if I didn't do this, I wasn't going to be very successful in my life. But I was. I mean, for some reason, I just wanted to be an FBI agent. I wanted to be in law enforcement. And, you know, I just, that's the path I went. And fortunately, I was able to get these positions and move on. And that's, it's been like, for me, it's been a dream come true, what I was able to do and what I've done. So.
Really? So what was your first office out of the academy?
My first office was Louisville, Kentucky. And that was, for me, a great opportunity. I was on, was able to work, get on the SWAT team. So I was able to do that right away, which is nice because when you go to a small to medium-sized field office, you get those opportunities. I was able to work drugs and the violations, bank robberies and things like that. So I was on a squad that we were able to do a lot of different things. And I think that that office allowed me to really grow as an agent immediately because you were given responsibilities. I had a great training agent by the name of Walt Jones who took me under his wing and really taught me a lot. And I don't think I could have handpicked a better field office than the Louisville office. The management was great. And again, they gave these first office agents an opportunity to spread your wings and do as much as you wanted to do. So I was very thankful for that. I got to the Louisville office in May of 1987.
So that's kind of when they first started getting into working drug cases. They did not work drug cases earlier on before that, but that was after the crack cocaine epidemic and that became such a huge problem in the cities that they opened that up to FBI agents.
A very defined path that we had to take because obviously DEA, we didn't want to intrude on what DEA was doing. So ours was very specific as, you know, what we were going to address as far as drugs and more organized groups type of thing. And actually, I got assigned to a task force shortly after getting there that addressed marijuana. And Kentucky was one of the few states known for some of the best marijuana in the world. And there's a little county down in, it's called Marion County, Kentucky. They were well known for their marijuana, and the FBI, along with several other agencies in Louisville, formed a task force to go after this group. So that's really what I worked for the majority of my time while I was in Louisville. And that was good, too, because it allowed me to really interact with other agencies and understand what it takes to cooperate because, you know, a lot of times there's a lot of infighting and territorial matters. But, it was nice to learn at a young age in the career how to get along with other agencies and what it takes to be successful in a joint operation.
Yeah, I know, like, you don't know Louisville or that, like, that county. I've read about that marijuana thing. There's a book on that, and there's a tricky little name to that. Well, I can't remember the name of it. Cornbread Mafia, and they were huge marijuana growers and purveyors. But you come in and you don't know the lay of the land. You don't know anybody but other FBI agents. But the local guys, many times they have grown up there. They've got already got contacts or some, you know kind of know who's who and or can reach out to find a contact just to find out something about different businesses and who owns them and, you know, who's right and who's wrong. And they really work together well. We did a lot of task forcing here in Kansas City, and I worked with a lot of FBI agents. And that's, you know, with the organized crime squad, the first thing they do is send a new agent over to the intelligence unit and a couple of guys that take him and just drive him around and, you know, show him the lay of the land. So,
well, the funny story as to how I got assigned to that was I got called into the assistant special agent in charge was our squad supervisor of such a small office. But he calls me in, and I've been in the office about 3 months, and he tells me what a great job I'm doing, and he's very, very impressed with what I've done. And he's going to present me with this great opportunity, and he tells me I'm going to be on this task force. And he says, Walt, your contact agent is going to take you down. There's a meeting today, and it's going to kick off this operation. You're the agent that we select to do this. So I'm like, wow, they really saw how great I am. You know, this I could barely get out of the office with my head was so big with all the things he said. So we get in the car, we're driving down, and Walt, again, my contact agent says, or my training agent says, you know why you got picked for this? I go, yeah. I said, Walt told me, or Marty told me about, you know, all the great things, how good I did. And he just looked at me and goes, no, not really. He said, about a year ago, the DEA had a case, and they were working with the Kentucky State Police, and we came in and stole the case from them. And he said, they haven't talked to us since, and they refused to work with us. But our headquarters is saying that we have to be a part of this task force. So Marty and I thought that you're new, they can't hate you that much. And so now we get to the meeting, and we walk in, and I'm like, oh my God, these people hate us. And so we walked into the room, and if looks could kill, Walt and I would have been dead. I mean, you could just feel the tension as soon as we walked in the room. And they're sitting like a half circle, and David Grice, who was the assistant United States attorney, was standing in front of everybody, and there's two seats at the end of the thing. Walt sits down, I sit down at the end, and I'm going, oh my God. You could just see that they did not want us there. You could just feel it. So David Grice introduces himself, talks about what we're going to do. He said, why don't we go around the room, everybody introduce yourselves, tell us, you know, what office you're with. And so they start at the far end, and they get around the Walt, and Walt Jones stands up. Now everybody knows Walt. And he says, I'm Walt Jones, I'm with the FBI, and if you play ball with us, we'll shove the bat right up your ass. I just looked at him, I go, oh. And there was some silence, and then everyone started to laugh. And I realized what Walt did is, look, we're sorry. We know what we did. We're going to give you this kid here, and, you know, we're going to make nice. It really turned out to be a fantastic operation, and we really got along very, very well. But it was a rude awakening for me. Is I had no idea what it was like until I walked in that room and just felt the tension. But again, some of those guys are still some of my best friends.
Yeah. Well, you know what we used to say, you know, the agent comes and says, hi, I'm the FBI and I'm here to help you. Like, yeah,
exactly.
Sure. You're here to steal the case. Get the credit.
Yep, that's exactly right.
Well, that's a pretty common thing everywhere you go. I worked a case with a ATF agent. I don't even know. He was just an aggressive young agent, and I had a little something going on a mob-run escort service, and he and I worked it and worked it and worked with the U.S. attorney and finally got enough, and they indicted the owner, and then the FBI agent was sent in because it was really an FBI violation, and the ATF couldn't actually prosecute this interstate transportation for prostitution. So that ATF agent, he was mad, but he also knew that, you know, we'd had fun, and what they think, his bosses weren't going to let him do it, and the U.S. attorney wasn't going to let him be the case agent.
Right.
And in the end, we went to trial.
Yeah. And you see it all the time on TV, Ali, when the FBI comes in, you know, everybody knows what they're there for, to steal the case. So, yeah. Like I said, Walt just put it right out there and let them know that, hey, we know what we did.
Yeah.
We're sorry.
That was pretty.
This guy's going to work with. So, like I said, it worked out really well. Very successful case. And still friends with several of those guys that I worked with.
Cool. So, you ended up going up to Cleveland, Ohio, which was the main thing we want to talk about. This is a heck of a story, folks. I'm telling you, I heard him telling this story on that other podcast. And I thought right then, I need to find him, get him on. And then I kind of got busy and I forgot about it. And I happened to notice his book somewhere on the internet. I can't remember how I found out about it again, but I saw that he had a book out, and then I remembered, oh yeah, I want him to tell this story and help you promote that book. What's the name of your book, Ray?
The name of the book is Broken Shield, an FBI Undercover Agent's Personal Perspective.
Interesting. So you got transferred to Cleveland. Was that like your offense of preference? Did you want to go to Cleveland, or was that they brought you in to work undercover?
Yeah, I tell you, it was really twofold. One, shortly after I got to the Louisville office, one of my squad mates, a guy by the name of Tom Nunnemaker, had just finished reading a book called Donnie Brasco, and gave it to me. He said, you need to read this book. It's a great book. And I'm sure, you know, the movie, Donnie Brasco and Joe Pistone, his story has been all over. And so I read the book, and honest to goodness, I was just enthralled with what Joe had done. And I just thought, man, this is the strongest man I've ever, emotionally, physically, mentally, what he went through, what he did, what he accomplished, just amazing. And I had never thought about doing undercover. I never was in law enforcement before I got to the FBI. I never did law undercover before I got to the FBI. But I thought, man, I would love to try this undercover stuff. I mean, that is, it's one, you against them. So second part of me wanting to go and do this undercover in Cleveland was the FBI at that time had all first office agents that went to smaller, medium offices, which is what Louisville was, would, after 3 years, be sent to a large field office, so one of our metropolitan field offices. And we had 12 of those. And one of those, they were like New York, L.A., Chicago, Miami. And every one of the first office agents in the Louisville division that got there before me were, every time they get their orders, it would be to New York. And they would come back with these horror stories about where they had to live, how much it was costing to live there, and the commute that they were going to have. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I don't want to go to New York. I know my wife doesn't want to go to New York. So I'm trying to think, how can I get out of this? Well, one of the agents in Kentucky, a gentleman by the name of Dan Estrom, was in the Elizabethtown NRA, and Dan had a great reputation, built a reputation as a great investigator, especially in corruption cases. And Cleveland happened to be looking for an agent like that. And Cleveland happened to be one of these major 12 field offices. How Cleveland got into that, I don't know, because they're really a small office, or at least a medium-sized office. But anyway, Dan got transferred to Cleveland. And about a year after Dan got there, this Tom Nonnemaker, who gave me the book about Joe Pistone, gets a call from Dan wanting to know if he wanted to do this undercover operation that Dan was getting started, a police corruption case in Cleveland. And Tom didn't want to go to Cleveland, but he knew I did. So he said, hey, you might want to give Dan Estrom a call and see. And I'm thinking, man, I don't have any. Tom was certified as an undercover agent. I had no experience. He said, give him a call. So I called Dan, and he remembered me. And I just said, Dan, I'd be interested in that undercover operation that you have. And I said, you know, I don't have any experience in undercover. I said, but it's something I really like to do. And he said, well, let me think about it and I'll get back to you. So he thought about it. I get a call. He said, why don't you move to Cleveland? We're going to interview you. So I went up for the interview, and the whole day of meeting with Dan and the special agent in charge and some of the other people in the office that were going to be involved in the case. And at the end of the day, Dan and the SAC called me into the office and said, you're our guy. And I asked Dan afterwards, after Special Agent Charge had left, I said, you know, why me? He goes, well, I said, to be honest with you, I didn't want any of these guys that have experience in undercover, because they come in with their own agenda. They come in with how they're going to do this and how they're going to do that. This is my case. I want someone fresh. I want someone that I know is going to do what I want them to do. And I said, so you're looking for someone with no experience? He goes, yeah. I go, well, you got your guy. I'm in. I'm in. Now, the case was targeted to Cleveland Police Department, and they were protecting, at the time, illegal casinos. And so I was going to have to, at some point, open up an illegal casino and get these police officers to protect that. The second strike was, I didn't gamble. I didn't know anything about gambling. I never played poker. I didn't know anything. So when Dan told me that, I said, well, Dan, I don't know anything about gambling. He said, don't worry about it. He said, I'm going to send you down to Quantico for about a week. He said, we're going to get a bunch of the agents, undercover agents that are experts in gambling. They're going to work with you. I said, okay, all right. So I went home, and at that point, my wife had no idea I was doing this. And I broke it to her that this is what was going to happen, and this is what I was going to do. And after I explained it to her, I'm thinking, what the hell did I get myself into? I have no undercover experience. I know nothing about gambling. And the subject is going to be Cleveland police officers. Who else knows more about what an undercover operation looks like than police officers? I may have bit off more than I can chew, but I committed to it. And Dan took a chance. I'm saying Dan took a chance on me. I'm going to go ahead and do this. So I did. I went down to Quantico before I got started on the operation, and spent a week with some of the best gamblers the FBI had to offer at the time, Herm Grumman, Ed Keller, Pete Crist, some of the best. And I spent a week with them, and we worked, card games, craps, every green game that they thought I'd be having to run at the casino, we went over and over. I acted as a player, I acted as a dealer, and Pete Crist, at the end of the week, knew that I still didn't get it. Now, we would do these scenarios all day, and then I go back and watch tapes to my room and go over everything that I learned that day, and come back the next day and see. And a week of this. At the end, Pete Crist, we had just broken up for the week, and Pete called me over and says, I know you probably, it looks like you still don't have this. So he made me a cheat sheet of, how to pay off gam bets and how to, what, like, three of a kind beats whatever. And he has this whole cheat sheet for me. He said, I think you're going to need this. And so I took it. I go, yeah, Pete, I will. And so I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to run a casino, and I really don't know how to do this stuff. But anyway, I kept working at it. That's basically the background that I went with when I got to Cleveland. And I started working. Dan introduced me when I got up to Cleveland, introduced me to confidential informant. And I just didn't trust this guy from the beginning. I didn't trust him. And I caught this guy in a couple of lies, and finally we got rid of him. And, Dan would bring in a couple of other confidential informants who didn't know who I was. They thought I was literally a bad guy that Dan was investigating. And, I started for the first 6 months, it was nothing but going to these bars where these police officers hung out and, trying to get them to, get to know me. And time during the day, I would run. Dan had the idea of a silk screening business. So I would make T-shirts, jackets, hats for these bars and then sell them. get contracts and sell them. That was my background. That's what I was doing. And it finally took about 6 months. And literally, the first thing I started to do was run a high-stakes poker game. And Dan had some informants that would send these gamblers in, and we'd run a high-stakes poker game, but I could not get any police to come. I mean, it was, and I was working literally, I'd work in the shop and throughout the day visit these bars, then at night go back out to these bars and just try to get conversations with police officers and see, you know, but I just wasn't getting anywhere. Just nothing was happening. They were all friendly to me, everything, everybody liked me. And it was, at one point, it was like, I don't know if you remember the show Cheers, the TV show, when Norm would walk in. And everybody say, Norm, you know, that they were doing that to when I walk into a bar, you know, Ray, how you doing? After about, it was almost going on 6 months, and we were getting ready to re-up for another, because these things would go, you have to get approval for 6 months. And then prior to the next 6 months, you had to tell, you know, basically rewrite another proposal and see if they would approve for the second one. Getting to the point, right, Dan was writing the proposal for the second 6 months, and we had just had another Friday night, another poker game, and I kept losing. I mean, these guys were killing me. But it just got to the point where after one night, I called Dan down. Yeah, basically, we played at my, I had another t-shirt shop, and then it was like a little shopping plaza, and basically stores just connected to one another, and I had the second one, but that's where I ran the casino, the poker games. And Dan was upstairs on the third floor of this building monitoring everything. Everything was recorded. And so at the end of the night, it's like now Saturday morning, I called Dan down after everybody had left, and I step on it and said, Dan, you're going to have to find somebody else. I can't do this. I said, I've been working, you know, nonstop, 7 days a week, 18, 19 hours a day. And I said, you're ready to re-up this thing, and I got no police officer. We got nothing but a high-stakes poker game going. Maybe you need somebody that has experience, that understands it, maybe more believable than I am. And it hurt me to say that, because I didn't want to quit on Dan because he took a chance on me. But it was to the point where we're not getting anywhere. This is nothing's happening. And Dan said, look, he basically said, you know, you've done more than we ever thought and gotten further than we ever thought we would. And he said, if you want to opt out and get out, he said, that's up to you. But if you do, I'm shutting this down because I can't bring anybody else in that would be able to do what you've done. And he continued to talk. And at the end, I just said, okay, look, I'll stay. Let's do this. And the following week, the main officer, a gentleman by the name of Bud, who I'd been working in and going to his bar constantly, finally came down and said, let me see what you got. And so we talked about the casino. He said, where's it going to be? So I took him next door and I showed him, told him, I said, this is where we have it. And he said, what are you going to have? I said, well, we're going to have craps table, going to have blackjack table, poker table, some slot machines. So he went through the whole process of what, you know, what he could offer me and what he would do. And that was how many officers and the fact that he would tell me how much I'd have to pay each officer. And he laid it all out. And fortunately, I was able to record everything that he said. And after he left, it was like a huge weight off my shoulder, like finally. And so I called Dan, and we went back to my undercover apartment, and I played the tape for him. And from that point forward, it was, you know, for a year and a half, running casinos every Friday night and with police protection. And it was at one point we got notified by these police officers that our location, we had moved it from the little shop that we had to this warehouse on the other side of town because the crowd got so big. And Dan had basically, we set up this basically a warehouse where the cars, the players would pull into the garage in the back, park their cars in the garage, and then up front of this warehouse is where the gaming was. I got a call from Bud that night. We were getting ready to go. He said, you need to meet me at the Holiday Inn. I said, Bud, we're getting ready to go. He said, you need to meet me at the Holiday Inn. Don't go to the warehouse. So I met Bud, and he tells me that the internal affairs is sitting outside waiting for us to show up. And, you know, so it was kind of like, wow, you know, hadn't gone there and not met with Bud, I would have been arrested. The whole thing would have been taken down by the Cleveland's internal affairs. So at that point, we shut it down and waited a couple of weeks, several weeks. In fact, we tried to run it at a hotel. We tried to keep the cops involved. And so I found a location at a hotel, and we tried to run it out of there, but it just didn't work out right. Logistics were just too hard. So we finally went back to the warehouse, but I had broken away from Bud's group and found another group of cops. We ended up 30 Cleveland police officers all together. And with this new group, with Bud's group, I didn't trust enough. Dan and I wanted to do a drug run to see if they would protect drugs. Bud's group, there was no way. I just didn't. Those guys were just they were uncontrollable at some point. And there were times where, you know, I really feared that they were going to rob me, casino. So when we broke away from them, we got with this new group of cops. And we basically really trusted these guys. And so we ran basically truckloads of marijuana. And we would have two trucks pull into the warehouse. One would be coming from like up north and the other one coming from Kentucky. And we'd have the police take the truck and escort it out of the city, so that they wouldn't get arrested while they did the transfer. And we did that several times as well. So it got really involved and really heated with what we were doing, and a lot of tension back at headquarters of us running these drugs and trying to coordinate that with DEA. In fact, that we had done a couple of these and we're getting ready to do a third one. And I'm at the warehouse and Dan Estrom called me, the case agent. He said, "You can't do this." And he says, "You're going to have to put it off." And I go, "What's the problem?" He says, "Well, DEA found out about it, and FBI now says we have to get their approval before we do this." I said, "Dan, they're about 10 minutes away, and the trucks are on their way." He said, "Well, you got to wait." He said, "You're going to have to wait until I call you back." I said, "Well, I'll tell you, here's what I'm going to do. You can call, but I'm not answering the phone." I said, "I'll take full responsibility for this." I said, "I'm not going to break this off." I said, "You know, it's DEA has nothing to do with it." And so we went ahead and did it, and I'm thinking, man, I hope this... hope this is okay, but just to feel right at that point saying, "No, we're not going to do this," and not have a really valid excuse not to do it. So we went ahead and did it. And after it was all over and everybody was, I paid the officers and got that all squared away. I got the call from Dan. He said, "DEA says it's okay." I go, "That's great, Dan."
I got a couple questions here before we get too far on down in the road on this. Now, when you started that big casino, did you bring other FBI agents in to act as dealers and help you with this? Or did you had to have some personnel, or did you just hire people that you'd gotten to know in the gambling business?
Yeah. Initially, what we did was, the one thing we had to do, we had to have, they wanted to have undercover agents in there for my protection, but also due to a surveillance law that with regards to recordings in Ohio, you can't record, like if several of the bad guys went off into part of the into a corner and started talking, we couldn't record that unless we had someone in the vicinity, an undercover agent in the vicinity. So that was the first thing. We field them, we bring undercover agents to act as gamblers. And then the first, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks that we ran this, myself and about 3 other undercover agents worked as the dealers, you know, and worked the sticks, the dealers, you know, dealt for blackjack. But I'm telling you, we were not good as, you know, the professionals are. So after about 3 or 4 weeks, I just talked to Dan and I said, "We got to find people who can do this." And so with the people, the gamblers that had come in, they knew people. And so I actually had professional dealers come in, people who had been in Vegas and done it for a while and then came back to Cleveland. So, and I was able to find through my contacts at the bars, other people who knew how to deal craps and deal blackjack and all of that. And so I hired those people to come in and work, and that alleviated the agents having to do that, because that was a lot of stress. And especially for, you know, like me, I'm trying to figure out, because you're talking about odds and insurance and all the things that they do, and I'm trying to figure all that out. So along with all the other stuff I had to do, that was really just too much. And so we were very fortunate that I got some very good dealers to come in every Friday night, work the casino. So that's
what did you pay one of those dealers for a typical Friday night shift?
I think we paid them about $200 to $250 a night. And then they got tips as well. The gamblers would often tip them as well. So
did you have drinks available too, like a little bar?
No.
Didn't do that at all?
No,
okay.
No. We had soft drinks and coffee. We were not allowed, and it was with all the money and the police. We weren't going to serve. We weren't going to have that liability of someone.
Yeah, when you were open, then what did these cops do? You had this one kind of a main guy, Bud, that you started off with, and lined you up with some others. What did he get? Some of his did they like all kind of work in the same unit or know each other? And then he would send guys down just to like work the door and hang out, make sure nobody robbed you. Was that their participation?
Yes. Bud had probably about 12 officers that he knew. He'd been a police officer for 20 years. He was working at the jail at the time. But the reason, again, these guys used to run casinos of their own or black, you know, run poker games on their own. So they knew what they were doing, and Bud knew who he could trust. And so he would bring in police officers, some that worked for him at the jail, but also others that he worked with throughout his career from different precincts would do it. And, you know, it was some, you know, basically I let Bud pick them. And then he'd bring them in, I'd interview them, make sure that they were okay. But I had to get them to in conversation to make sure that we had them on tape, knowing that they were willing to do this and what they weren't bringing for. You know, you have to get conversations out there so that you can't say that there was entrapment and all the other issues that come with this. So it was Bud bringing them in, me basically, you know, filling them out, getting them on. And then throughout the night, either me or one of the other undercover agents would engage in conversation. But we would have at the shop on the east side, which was kind of a small shop that was next to my t-shirt shop, we had four officers inside and two outside that would, you know, stay because we were in a neighborhood. And so we had to make sure that nobody was being attracted to the place and making sure that everything outside was okay. And then when we moved to the warehouse, we added probably three or four more additional police officers to work the garage area, the, you know, letting people in and out. And then up front, we had them at each table to make sure nobody was stealing and that kind of, you know, that kind of stuff. But it was, you know, the other thing, you run into all kinds of issues with when you're doing these kinds of things. And one of, you know, when I first started this with Bud, Bud just laid it out that I had to pay him and then he would pay the officers. I wasn't to pay the officers. I wasn't to count the money. I mean, this was all the stuff that he had laid out. And I played it for the Assistant United States Attorneys and Dan and the people who were doing the administrative stuff on the case. And after a couple of weeks, the AUSA, the Assistant United States Attorney, Bob Bulford, said, "Ray, we got to have you count the money. And you got to pay each officer separately." I go, "We've already been through this. They're not going to let me do that." He said, "You're going to have to do it." So when I would pay Bud, I'd have all the money already counted out, and I'd just hand it to him, and he would take it. And when he paid the officer, I said I wanted to be there when he paid the officer just to make sure that he's not keeping the money. So we did have that worked out. So what I decided to do was, instead of having all the money counted, I put money in all different pockets. I put it in my desk drawer. And so when Bud came in, I just started pulling money out. And now this is all on camera. And I pulled some money. I said, "Count that. Tell me how much. What do you got there?" And he, "You got 75. Okay. And I pull out some more money. What do you got? Until we got to the amount that I owed Bud. And I said, "Okay, send in whoever the next guy is." And we go through the same thing. I just keep pulling money out from different places. And Bud would count it. And then, you know, he'd say, "That's 100. I go, "Okay, that's 100. And then I'd give, you know. So that's how I got around not counting the money. I had Bud, basically had Bud count the money for me. So those are, like, say,
how much did you pay each one of these guys for an evening shift? Kind of like working an off-duty job, you know, you go in at the end and they pay you like $50 for your 3 hours or whatever.
Yeah, these guys, like I say, we'd start at 9 o'clock in the morning and run till 8 or 9 o'clock Saturday morning. So these guys were there for about 12 hours. Bud got $500 and everyone else, the other officers got about $250.
Interesting. So, you know, you ran this for a while and then how did you like move into another group of officers? Was there somebody out of this group that, you know, you felt like you could talk to and then he introduced you into some more?
Well, Dan Estrom, as I said early on in his career, was very good at getting cooperating witnesses and confidential informants. And so when we broke away from Bud's group, Dan had me introduced to a gentleman by the name of Reggie, who was a bail bondsman. And Reggie was a former police officer. And so I got introduced to Reggie, and Reggie and I hit it off pretty well. Reggie wanted to make some money. And when he found out what I was doing, he immediately had contacts. And so through Reggie, I was able to start meeting these other police officers and got them, you know, basically would lay it out to them what we were doing. And, you know, they would agree to do it. And then, like I say, they agreed to the casino, protecting the casino. And then this group also agreed, some of them agreed to protect those drug shipments. And Reggie even had set up a meeting with a judge. And I get a call from Reggie, "I need to meet him down." His office was right next to the courthouse. And so he said, "Meet me down at the office at noon today." So I drive down to his office and waiting outside. He's coming out of the courthouse and he's waving me over to the courthouse. Now I'm wired. I got my recorder on. I'm ready to record the conversation. And he says, "Come on." He says, had dinner with Judge and he gave me the name. And he said, "They want to meet with you. They're willing to help you out." So I'm, wow, okay. So I'm all excited and we're walking up to the courthouse and he keeps talking and I'm getting more and more excited. I'm thinking, man, Dan's going to be really happy with this. We're going after judges now. And so he takes me up and he opens the door. And I realize I got to go through a magnetometer to get into the courthouse. And I start, Reggie, come on. I don't want to go up to her. I'd up to the office. Let's just set this up for later. Maybe we can have dinner. No, she's waiting for you. Come on. And he keeps dragging me. And I'm thinking, well, this is over now. The magnetometer is going to go off. They're going to search me. There's going to be a recorder. This whole thing's over. And just as we get to the magnetometer, he grabs me by my arm and takes me around and tells the police officer, the court officer, he's with me. And we go. And, you know, he had such a great reputation because he was always in and out of there as a bail bondsman that they all knew him. And he was able to take me right around the magnetometer. And we did go up. We went up to the judge's office and had a very good conversation. And about 2 days later, Reggie gets arrested for narcotic possession of narcotics. And that part of the investigation with the judges and some of the other people he was going to introduce me to just went. They wouldn't even talk to me. But the police officers, you know, basically we continued, and I would get more police officers through the one gentleman that was basically the lead guy that Reggie had introduced me to. And so it was through him that I was able to go ahead and get additional police officers. So there's always something coming up. There's always issues and problems, and these things never go smoothly. And you just got to be, like I say, quick on your feet and hope that you get breaks like the fact that I didn't have to go through a magnetometer. And, you know, so it's just, and then the other ironic thing was one of the main characters in the case, the name of the case was Chiron, and it was after Shirley and Ron. And Shirley was a bag lady for Ron Chismar, who ran a bookmaking operation. And so I became good friends with Shirley, getting to know Shirley, and she ran a bar. And Shirley, during the middle of the operation, was getting married. Decided to get married, and she asked me to give her away at her wedding. And so, I said, I hope I don't have to get approval from headquarters to do this, but yeah, I'd be more than happy to do it. So you develop these relationships that it's just, to give somebody away at their wedding. And I know that when she was arrested, she was very upset with me and not happy when she did see me at the end, because I had, when they brought all the police officers in, when they arrested everybody, I had to positively identify them. And she was not happy when she saw me. And I'm just thinking, unfortunately, I'm on her way, the video for a wedding, walking her
really?
Down. Yeah.
So, Ray, Cleveland's a mob town. Did you ever, did they ever come to your attention, or do you come to their attention where they wanted to shake you down, to get a little piece of your action? Or were you operated under the radar of all that?
You know what? We were kind of under the radar, but I did hear from Dan Ashton through another agent on the organized crime squad that they had told Dan that the mob knew that there was a game in town, a new casino, an illegal casino in town, and they figured it had to be.
Really?
So the mob figured it out, but the police didn't. So they, like I say, I never had any run-ins or anything like that. But that was one of the things that the information that got back to Dan was that the mob kind of, I heard about it and kind of stayed away because they thought it had to be the FBI doing it.
So these cops, you operated this whole time. Did you have any liaison with the Cleveland PD at all, or was there internal affairs, or did you stay totally off their radar?
No, we made it. It wasn't my decision. The case agent and the front office made a conscious decision not to include the Cleveland Police Department because at that point, they didn't trust it. They felt that if they had brought them in, word would get back and the case would be done. But what our SAC did do, just a few days before we were doing the arrest, he brought Chief Kovacic in at the time and told him what was going on. And basically, when they did the press interviews and releases, the SAC, Bill Brannon, stated that we had worked hand in hand with the Cleveland Police Department. And it was basically a safe face for them. But, they were kind of, from what I understand, they were upset with the fact that we didn't tell them. But there was just no one in the FBI, in the hierarchy, felt that would be the right thing to do or the safe thing to do, because they just didn't trust anybody.
I agree from what you've told me. That many guys involved, that. And plus, like, you got ratted out to internal affairs. At least they had some redeeming qualities that internal affairs was working that thing and knew cops. There were dirty cops, and then they got ratted out. So that's what would have happened if you'd have told them. They would have, no cop had ever talked to you.
And ironically, when we did bring them in to help with the arrests and all of that, and so at the end when they're bringing all of the subject in for positive identification, one of the IA officers came up to me, introduced himself. He said, I'm with Internal Affairs, and I saw him, nice to meet you. He said, I wanted to kick your ass. And I just look at him and I go, why? He goes, I was in the dumpster that night waiting for you to show up. So he told me at that point, he said, we were all around the place. And he said, I was in the dumpster right outside the garage door. And I go, oh, okay. And he said, when you didn't show up, I was pissed.
So they were, and they knew there was dirty cops. That's why it was Internal Affairs, and they were after the cops as well as you.
Okay. Right.
Well, good. Yep. I'm glad to know that it wasn't totally, absolutely, totally 100% corrupt. I hate hearing these kinds of stories, but as we talked on the phone before, it seems to me like up to Kansas City, and we had some small problems, but nothing on this scale, but we just didn't have that institutional corruption that seemed like you have east of here, like Chicago and Cleveland and New York City, and we just didn't have it at all.
Yep, I tell you, that's very fortunate that you have police departments like that. Basically, there's no corruption. People do, they get hired to protect the citizens and the laws, and that's what they do. It seemed like this group that we were working with, that was the last thing on their mind. They used the badge for all of their personal
benefit. That's too bad, but it happens. You know, I always say you can't have a big city without having a little corruption, but that was a little too much corruption. Makes it more colorful place in a way, but.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
Ray, this has been great. This is a hell of a story, man. I'm telling you, and that was, what you lived. How what was the total length of time you were really undercover? And did you have, like Joe Pistone, did you have your own apartment? Did you live the life 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and then go see your wife and family, you know, some periodically?
Yes. I was undercover for 2 years, from 89 to 91. And then Dan, basically, we were able to go right to trial in 92 because we were prepared, ready to go. So from 89 to 91, I was undercover. 91 to 92, I was preparing for trials. Now, as far as I did have an undercover apartment, which I stayed at, because, I would get to my shop about 8:30 in the morning and run that till about 5, close that, go home, go to my apartment, get showered, change, get something to eat, and I'd go hit the bars until 1:30, 2 o'clock at night. Then I come back to the apartment, and all the recordings I made, I had to mark and then write up a 302 on what was on, who was on the tape, what was on the tape, and then put that all away. So by the time I get to bed, it'd be like 3, get up at 7, and go back and do the whole thing all over again. I didn't get home very often. And at one point, I got a call by my wife, text by my wife, I needed to come home. And she had the kids packed, and she left me. And, you know, at that point, it was like she just had enough. When I did go home, it was, and it's hard to explain, but physically I was there, but mentally I was, you know, worried about the case, thinking about the case. I didn't want to hear the problems that she was having with the, because we had two young sons at the time. And I just, very selfish of me. And this is what happens when you get wrapped up in an investigation like this, is that takes all of, for me, it took all of my attention. Every thought was about this case. And for the life of me, didn't care what was going on at home, because I figured I had more important things to do. And so after about 8-9 months of that, my wife took the kids and left. And I was okay, or at least I thought I was. And one of the things the FBI does, which I think is fantastic, is all undercover agents, before you go into a project, has to have a psychological exam. And then you're interviewed after you take these tests, then you're interviewed by one of our behavioral scientists, psychologists, that basically make sure that you're okay. And so every 6 months, you got to take these tests and go back for these interviews. And so this happened, and I think 2 months went by. My wife is gone. Nobody knew. I didn't tell the case agent. I didn't tell anybody that they had left and my wife was and kids had gone. I had to go back to Quantico to take this test. And so this would have been about the third or fourth time I've taken the test and then meet with the psychologist. And so I figured I knew this test. I mean, I've taken it so many times, it went right through it. And after you take the test, it's about a four to five hour test that you take, and then they score it, and then they call you down, and you go through it with them. Well, I took the test and got called down, and I walked into the psychiatrist's office, and he says, what's the matter? And I go, nothing, why? He goes, tell me what the problem is. I go, Steve, I have no problem. I'm good. He goes, Ray, you're tighter than a drum. He said, this test really has me concerned. And I'm thinking, I answered it the way I always answer it. He kept asking me, and he said, look, I'm going to take you off the project if you don't tell me what's going on. At that point, I said, look, my wife left, and she's in Pittsburgh. and went on. And he just looked at me and said, did you drive here? I said, yeah. He said, I want you to get in the car and drive to Pittsburgh and get with your wife and family and get that squared away. He said, I'm going to call Cleveland. I'll tell them I wanted you to just take a couple of weeks off. And you needed some time off, but you take care of that. And once you've taken care of that, you get back to me. So I went to Pittsburgh and I cried. You know, I did a lot of crying and apologizing and finally listened to what my wife had to say. And we worked it out. We had been married up, I think, 10 years at that point. And she knew me very well and understood. And so what we decided was she was going to stay in Pittsburgh with the kids and just let me finish the project. And I would go to Pittsburgh periodically after that. But it affects you. It changes you. And I thought I was fine. It wasn't until I took that damn test that I realized that, you know, something's wrong and I got to get this squared away. And thank God for the FBI behavioral science and the psychiatrists who, like I say, they really take care of their undercover agents. Had he not, probably just allowed my wife and the family to leave and I would have moved on. But we've been married now 41 years and everybody's good. That was, it takes a toll on you mentally and physically. It's one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in my life. And it's something that I'm very proud of having done it. But I understand what I did to my family as well.
You did a hell of a job. I'll tell you what, that was a huge sacrifice you made and cleaned up a whole police department like that. Because I would imagine, I know enough about this, that you take down that many guys on one police department. That police department has to fundamentally change. They have to have some kind of a change from one end to the other, probably starting with a new chief pretty quick and looking at their hiring practices and start really weeding out the bad eggs. Did you see any kind of a change with the Cleveland PD after that?
Yeah, I had left. They had moved me. I got transferred to Atlanta for my protection. The whole thing was I wanted to just go to the Youngstown field office and work there. But because there were some threats made by some of the officers on me and my family that they covertly moved us to Atlanta. So, but I did hear from the agents and the supervisor who I'm still in touch with and I'm still good friends with. There was a lot of fundamental changes. The mayor got involved. It was a lot of changes that were implemented into that. And again, I think internal affairs did a lot as well, knowing that they had this problem.
Interesting. Well, Ray, this has been great. I really appreciate you coming on telling this story. You left the FBI. What have you been doing ever since besides writing books and...
Well, actually, you know, it took me 30 years to write the book, and it wasn't until I did the podcast that you mentioned with Jerry Williams. I had never had any intentions of writing a book. I figured throughout my career, you know, I negatively affected 47 families' lives. I didn't see any reason to write a book, and so I never wrote anything about it. But when I did Jerry Williams' podcast, after I'd done it, I got a call from a couple of the undercover agents who I've known or heard of. Jack Garcia, one of them. Jack's been on 60 Minutes. As soon as I finished my undercover operation, I met Joe Pistone, which was a huge thrill. But then Joe and I have been friends, and I've done things with Joe, and they convinced me to write the book. They said, you need to write your story. So I guess it was 2 years ago I started doing it and finally finished it last year.
Yeah, we've had talked to Joe a couple of times. He's been on the podcast here and on a couple of different shows. One just a little cameo appearance for one thing, and then he and his podcasting partner came on and we did kind of a show kind of promoting their new podcast. And Jack Garcia was just on here not too long ago. So you're fine company there. I really applaud your work.
Yeah, those guys are truly amazing.
They are. I worked, you know, what we'd call semi-undercover. You know, we wore t-shirts and blue jeans and sports jackets and things like that and just followed guys around and never really like came off as police officers. But as far as that actually working day to day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or even going in and fronting myself off as a criminal, another criminal, I never did that. And I don't think I could have done it. It takes a special talent to do that because those people, they've got this native intelligence that they spot things that you don't even think about. I had a kid one time tell me, he said, I know you cops. You think you're being undercover. He said, you touch your gun all the time. It's like, oh, shit. I just realized I do that. So there's lots of little tells, and you had to master all of those. So that's you did a hell of a job, man. What have you done since? Are you, besides writing a book, are you working, like investigations for anybody, or are you just totally retired?
No, I retired, and I worked for a couple of years with a casino and then with Siemens Corporation. And for the past 7 years, I've been with the Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission as their chief compliance officer. I head up their investigative unit. And that's, I don't know what I would do if I retired. I got no skills or abilities, so no hobbies. I don't know what else I would do. So.
All right, Ray. So, folks, the book is Broken Shield by Ray Morrow. Find it on Amazon. You've got a website, I believe.
Yeah, it's BrokenShieldRayM.com.
Okay, and do you have Facebook? Or,
and there's a lot of information.
You have Facebook
there.
Or Twitter and any of that?
Yeah, I do, yes. I don't have Twitter, but I do have Facebook.
Okay, so.
It's just, that's Broken Shield.
Okay, that's what I figured. Just go out, folks, just go out and search in your Facebook mechanism for Broken Shield, and you can keep up with Ray, and people like to keep up with what's going on. It's a really interesting book. Now, have you sold the screen rights to anybody yet? I figured
yes,
you did.
Yes, actually, right after the podcast I did with Jerry Williams, I got a call from a Hollywood person by the name of Justin Shankaro. Justin purchased the rights to the, to the story, and we've been working on a film, writing for the film. Things have kind of slowed down because of the pandemic, but I'm hoping 2021 we're able to get things kicked back to where it needs to be so we can get this thing done.
All right, Ray. Folks, look for the movie and go get the book. So, Ray, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Gary, thank you for having me. It has been a pleasure.
Right,
thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, folks, thank you for listening and all your nice comments on the Apple Podcast reviews, plus your nice comments on my YouTube channel, where I often put up the at least the Zoom interviews so you can see what my guests look like in real life. Also, on our Facebook group, Gangland Wire Podcast, I see a lot of really good compliments on that. I've got some great people that help put up really good content, so if you want more mob information than you can shake a stick at, go to Gangland Wire Podcast Facebook page, or actually it's a group. Remember that if you support the podcast with some donations, you'll get an invite to my live Zoom call, where we'll share stories, answer questions, and in general have a good time. Don't forget to buy me a cup of coffee or a shot and a beer on Venmo on your Venmo app, or you can go to Gangland Wire, my website, ganglandwire.com, and donate. I have a donate page, and each podcast that I put up has a pretty lengthy written blog piece about what the subject is, and at the bottom of that page, there's a way to donate. I have some fixed costs, and plus I'm raising some money for my next documentary, which is about the KC mob and the election fraud of 1946. I've already had to hire a film guy to do a couple of my interviews, and I have one more interview to film. Plus, I have an artist that I pay to do some illustrations for my movie. If you remember from Brothers Against Brothers or Gangland Wire, I use some illustrations in those. And by the way, you can rent those on Amazon for only $1.99 or $2.99 if you want the HD version. And finally, I have my book, Leaving Vegas, the true story of how FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos. Now, that title is a mouthful. But in that book, you're going to find copies of a lot of the transcripts of the actual wiretaps. And if you get the Kindle version, I took those audios that I got out of the court files and linked them to the book in the proper places. I have an explanation and then the actual audio wiretap, which I think is kind of unusual. So you can go to Amazon and get that book and get it in the Kindle version. Gangland Wire supports the Veterans Administration and their programs that help veterans with PTSD. You can call their hotline at 1-800-873-8255 and push 1. Or go to their website, www.ptsd.va.gov. I hate saying that www. I left it out when I said something about Gangland Wire. You guys all know I can leave that out. Anyhow, thanks a lot for listening, and listen up next week. I try to put out one a week. Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.